Statewide satellite distribution of this program is made possible by the Lawrence Group, providing residents throughout New York State with total insurance coverage.
This program is a production of WAMC News. From Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly half-hour review of New York State government and politics. Your host is political scientist and syndicated columnist Dr. Alan Chartok of the State University.
Hello and welcome to the Legislative Gazette. I'm Don Decker, sitting in for Alan Chartok this week. On the Legislative Gazette this week, we'll hear about Governor Cuomo and his difference with the Democratic National Chairman over what was said on the subject of General Sherman. Why is New York wrestling with the federal government to get an Indian museum placed in the state? We'll hear from environmentalists who think New York isn't doing enough to clean up hazardous waste sites. And we'll get the latest on the contamination of the areas around the Ciba Geigy plant on the Hudson River. This and much more, all coming up on this week's Legislative Gazette. Governor Cuomo continues to figure prominently in opinion polls all over the country on Democratic presidential candidates, despite his protest that he is not in the running. Maury Small reports.
A new survey of California voters puts the New York governor at the head of the pack of Democratic candidates, even though he's the one who insists he's not running for president. The poll released Wednesday by the Field Institute asked voters to say who they'd be inclined to vote for. They could name more than one candidate. Cuomo was favored by 49% of California Democrats, followed by Jesse Jackson with 37%, and Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis at 32%. The pollsters say another survey in the most populous state, this one not restricted to Democratic voters, says Cuomo is about as popular as the two leading Republican candidates, Vice President George Bush and Senate Minority Leader Robert Dole. At a Capitol press conference Tuesday, Cuomo insisted that he would not discuss himself and the White House. New York Post reporter Fred Dicker tried to get the governor to comment on his appearance last week on a network news program when Cuomo again refused to rule out a draft for the nomination in case the Democratic convention deadlocks.
I'm not going to discuss myself and the presidency.
Is it fair to say that your position now is that you'll take a draft if they make it?
I'm not going to discuss myself and the presidency.
But that position doesn't rule
out. I'm not going to discuss myself and the presidency.
You're not changing your position.
I'm not going to discuss
Brokaw.
Myself and the president.
I'm talking about Tom Brokaw and what you said to him.
Y no hablo del presidencia y Mario Cuomo.
Eventually, the governor did offer one interesting revelation. He said Democratic National Committee Chairman Paul Kirk asked him not to make a Sherman-esque statement. That refers to Civil War General William Sherman's famous telegram to the 1884 convention, warning that if nominated, he would not accept, and if elected, he would not serve.
I'll talk now about the chairman of the party, not about me. There was a story in one of the local papers here, distributed statewide, that said that the chairman of the party asked me to make a Sherman-esque, and I demurred. The truth was exactly the opposite. Exactly the opposite. And we simply called the columnists and said, well, we've seen you do this before, but would you mind checking with Mr. Kirk and then printing the truth, which is that Mr. Kirk said exactly the opposite. He said, please don't make a Sherman-esque.
Paul Kirk, however, issued a statement that afternoon describing a slightly different conversation with Cuomo. While Cuomo said Kirk asked him not to make a Sherman-esque, Kirk says he simply told the governor it was not necessary for him to rule out a draft since he has consistently said he's not running. Kirk said he and Cuomo agreed that the Democratic candidate will come from the current field of contenders. The Democratic committee chairman also said he was irritated by Cuomo's remarks because he considered their conversation confidential. At this week's press conference, Governor Cuomo was also asked whether he thinks there's too much media scrutiny of candidates' personal affairs. Cuomo responded that the reporters who delve deeply into candidates' lives should undergo equally close scrutiny themselves.
Why doesn't the media answer those questions? If you think the politicians should answer it on the grounds that they're aspiring to office, and they're important, they have no constitutional obligation to tell you whether they smoked pot, But it's important to the people of this nation to know what kind of people would be leaders. Isn't it important to the people of this nation to know what kind of people would write their columns and seek to influence them? This is not me speaking. This is Abe Rosenthal, former managing editor of the mightiest newspaper in the country, perhaps, the New York Times, who says, let the media answer. I tried it with the Post. I didn't get any answer. They asked me about pot smoking. I said, okay, I'll answer, but I want to ask you, your reporters and editors, please respond. They never did. That's interesting, you know. Why not? Why shouldn't Fred Dicker say in print, yes or no?
The Cuomo stressed that scrutiny of reporters should not be mandated by the government, which he says should have no regulatory power over the media. For the Legislative Gazette, this is Maury Small.
Some observers say the governor seems to be burning both ends of the candle, but if so, what's he hoping to achieve? Alan Shartok spoke with Fred Dicker of the New York Post about this subject.
Freddie, here's the question. Mario Cuomo is certainly the most talked about thing, if not in the state, then certainly in the United States in terms of candidacy. What exactly is going on? We have a whole bunch of things happening. First of all, Jesse Jackson announces that he thinks that Mario Cuomo, ought, if he's going to get into it, ought to have been playing within the same rules everybody else is. Is that essentially what happened?
Yeah, you know, everything was triggered last week when national television, I guess it was NBC, and Tom Brokaw carried the story in which the governor, in effect, said, if they hand me the nomination on a silver platter, I'll take it and run. He had been saying for months and months that he wouldn't rule out the possibility of a draft at the convention. In the Tom Brokaw interview, Alan, he said, yes, if there is a draft, I'm going to run for president. Now, that produced tremendous response, I think principally because it was on national TV. Cuomo correctly had noted that he had pretty much said the same thing all along, but because it was broadcast nationally, the time was right. Clearly, there's no front runner in a Democratic primary. It got a tremendous response. Now, just a couple of days later, Jesse Jackson was in Buffalo. He was asked about this, and I think quite understandably, he said, look, if I'm going to lose in my bid to get the nomination, I sure as heck would like to lose to somebody who's in the race and playing by the rules, not someone who comes in at the very last minute without having gone through the agony and the effort of a primary series of campaigns, and steps in and just takes it without giving anything to the party. So he was annoyed at the governor, and I think understandably so.
Well, now, Fred, you say that understandably so. It almost sounds like you're endorsing what he's saying, and let me just stop you and before you go ahead and rip my throat out, but say to you, but really, why is it outside the rules? For example, the convention rules do allow delegates to switch their choice if there's a deadlock, so he would be within the rules in that case.
Technically, you're absolutely correct, Alan. It's outside the rules in the sense that the Democratic Party over the years and the Republican Party, too, has evolved a system by which the assumption is the active members of a particular party, in this case the Democratic Party, should have a right to choose who the party's nominee is. Now, of course, the draft scenario for the governor would, by definition, assume that the party members themselves will not be able to reach a consensus, and that's certainly possible. I just say it's understandable for Jackson because it's not easy for these people to go through all these primaries. There's no question they invest an enormous amount of their own emotional capital, time, and finances. And I can understand how someone who goes through this process would be a bit resentful, greatly resentful of someone like Governor Cuomo who's standing on the sidelines and apparently is doing better than all the people who are in the race and actively campaigning. It's an amazing phenomenon, and I could see that there would be some resentment.
Okay, point number one was Jesse Jackson. Point number two, we get now to the second of the great contenders, and that is Mr. Michael Dukakis and Dukakis's aides. Remember, the same sort of aides who did in Mr. Biden are now coming out and saying that they think that Mario is playing games, or at least that's the way they're quoted. What's that mean?
Well, look, once again, and I think it could be linked to Jesse Jackson's statements, there's some resentment in the Dukakis camp over some comments that the governor had given the New York Times, I think about a week and a half ago, which seemed to be taking a shot at Mike Dukakis, who, after all, the governor had encouraged to get into the race. I think it's not just Jesse Jackson and Mike Dukakis, though. There's a lot of resentment out there because these people, as I had indicated earlier, are working very, very hard in the governor by standing here in Albany and giving some pronouncements now and again keeps being shown to be potentially the most powerful candidate the Democrats have. I think the problem with Dukakis has pretty much largely been taken care of. I know the governor was personally annoyed that Dukakis had come to New York about 3 weeks ago, given a speech down in New York City, and never even mentioned the governor. Certainly some of the governor's key aides were annoyed by that. They thought it was a slight at New York's leader, and I'm sure if the governor went to Boston to give a speech, he would mention Mike Dukakis. So there's, tense nerves, there's anxiety, there are people who are snapping at each other, because the bottom line, I think, is that the Democratic Party is in big trouble.
Okay, the third great incident in all of this was an altercation, or at least a difference of opinion, with Mr. Kirk, the chairman of the Democratic Party. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, that was a very interesting one, Alan. And as you know, it was just a couple of days ago. The governor, under some pressure to talk a bit more about whether or not he would like to be a presidential contender, said that he had decided against issuing a statement that would rule out any possible presidential run this year, or actually next year, I'm sorry, in the upcoming campaign, partly on the advice of Paul Kirk, the Democratic national chairman. Well, that struck a lot of people as pretty big news, and it came at a time when the governor said he was imposing a gag rule on himself, that he wouldn't talk about his candidacy anymore, and all of a sudden he seemingly let this big, important story out of the bag. I, like everybody else, immediately put calls into Mr. Kirk down at the Democratic National Committee in Washington. And then after about 2 or 3 hours, we got a response from Kirk's spokesman, which was a little mystifying, Alan. And what the response said was that, indeed, Paul Kirk said that he had urged the governor not to make a what they call a Sherman-esque statement of unequivocally ruling out a possible candidacy. But then he added he had only done so because the governor had assured him, well, he's not going to be a candidate under any conditions anyway. So Kirk then said, well, then, of course, there's no need for this kind of Sherman-esque statement. In addition, Kirk, in his statement, noted, and I think quite pointedly, that he had expected the conversation he had with the governor to remain confidential. So you had the seeming contradiction by Paul Kirk of the governor's description of why Kirk had supposedly asked the governor not to say he would never be available as a candidate in the next election. And you had this sort of pointed observation about a confidential meeting. It sounded as if the governor, if Kirk is to be believed, had mischaracterized what had taken place.
Do you think the governor has it in him to do that?
I do, Alan. At times, I think the governor, if only just to tease people, will take some liberties with the truth.
The final question is, you have said all along, have you not, that you didn't think Mario Cuomo was running for president. And since that is the A question on everybody's lips, winning in California in the polls, you know,
it's amazing,
doing all this stuff, is it still your opinion that he's not running?
It is, Alan, and I would challenge those political groupies out there who really are convinced that the governor is going to be running to get in contact with me, because I'm going to take any and all bets I can find on it, and I think I'm going to win a lot of money this time around.
Fred Dicker of the New York Post. Negotiations between New York State and its largest public employees union began this week with a hard line from the governor. Governor Cuomo said state workers may have to tighten their belts so the state can afford more worthy programs. The governor says he expects economic growth in the state to slow down over the next few months. There are 200,000 state employees covered by the CSEA, the Civil Service Employees Association, the Public Employees Federation, known as PEF, and other unions. Labor negotiator Elizabeth Moore began the talks with the CSEA this week, and she'll be meeting with PEF next week. Cuomo said New York has the best workforce in America, and he wants to see them fairly compensated. But he warned state economies would begin to feel the fallout of the recent stock market collapse. That, the governor said, leaves less money for the homeless, the elderly, education, roads, bridges, and other needs. The CSEA president, Bill McGowan, said that the union only wants what's fair and equitable for the people who make the state of New York work. It's been a year now since the voters of New York passed a bond act that put $1.5 billion of taxpayers' money aside to clean up toxic landfills and acquire environmentally sensitive land. The state says it's accomplished a great deal, but environmentalists are saying it hasn't done nearly enough. Brenda McMahon has more.
The Environmental Planning Lobby, the New York Environmental Institute, and the Toxics in Your Community Coalition blasted New York State and Governor Mario Cuomo for not working fast enough to clean up the toxic waste sites in New York. The 1986 Environmental Quality Bond Act allocated $1.2 billion for the cleanup of hazardous waste sites and $250 million toward the acquisition of environmentally sensitive land. The Bond Act is designed to get responsible corporations to clean up their share of the waste, and the state will pay for the rest. But Larry Shapiro, executive director of the Environmental Planning Lobby, says to date nothing has been done.
We're now more than a year later after the Bond Act was passed by the voters. The Department of Environmental Conservation still hasn't spent a penny of the Bond Act money on cleaning up hazardous waste sites, and we think this is really a breach of faith with the voters.
Shapiro says the problem is that the State Department of Environmental Conservation and the governor's office are handling the large corporations with kid gloves. Instead, Shapiro says they should pressure the companies to clean up the dumps, and if they don't, sue them.
The toxic cleanup, which is by far the major portion of the money under the Bond Act, we don't even know when they're planning to start. And in their negotiations with polluters, they don't even set deadlines to say to the polluters, you got to clean up by such and such a date, otherwise we're going to go in and we're going to pay for the cleanup and then we're going to sue you for reimbursement.
Shapiro says another problem is that New York hasn't hired enough extra workers to deal with the cleanup. Comparing New York with Massachusetts, who apparently plans to hire 400 additional workers, Shapiro says New York has only hired 60. To this comment, Governor Cuomo, at a press conference, says he'll hire as many additional workers as needed.
I will almost certainly ask for whatever Commissioner Jawling recommends.
What is he recommending?
Well, we'll know when we get to the budget.
He said he'd put in his recommendation.
Well, you'll know when we get to the budget.
New York State NCON Commissioner Thomas Jawling has put in a request for additional staff, but he hasn't revealed how many extra hands he's asked for. Jawling says he didn't want to hire 400 people at once. Rather, he wants to phase in those workers. He also says the environmental groups are right. The Bond Act money has not yet been used. But that's because New York has been in the process of getting responsible companies to pay for the cleanup of the landfills before using the taxpayers' money.
The program anticipates responsible party cleanup, and we're seeing that performance in the state of New York. We will be identifying those sites for which responsible parties are simply not candidates, and that we will be taking action on those sites. But there are precious few sites out there for which responsible parties have not been identified and for which responsible parties are now being prosecuted or negotiated with in order to achieve that cleanup. So I think our achievement should be measured not in how much taxpayer money we spend, but in how much responsible party money we spend.
Jawling says it was important to pass the Bond Act so that corporations who are responsible for the cleanup of hazardous waste would know the state was serious. According to the Bond Act, if corporations refuse to clean the sites, they'll be fined and billed, and then New York will clean up the landfills. Jawling says that threat has worked like a charm.
I think it was necessary for credibility behind the program to have state resources that would contribute seriously and significantly to that ultimate program size. That's why the Bond Act was the vehicle to achieve it. The fact is that it is working magnificently in inducing responsible party cleanup, and that's to the benefit of the people of New York.
To date, Jawling says 111 companies have come forward to investigate their role in the cleanup process, and 60 more companies are expected to come forward next year. He also says New York will begin spending the Bond Act money in 1988. When asked if too much money was requested in the bond, Jorling said maybe, but it's too early to tell. For the Legislative Gazette, this is Brenda McMahon.
New York State Senator Franz Lechter of Manhattan has proposed that the states of New York and New Jersey declare a ceasefire in their economic war and form a joint economic cooperation council instead. He said that such a bi-state agency would make sure that various firms or industries don't play off one state against the other. Lechter said that present agencies have not been able to prevent such competition. The legislator said that he has been joined by New Jersey State Senator Richard Van Wagner of Middlesex and New York State Assemblyman Maurice Hinchey of Kingston in calling for a ceasefire in the border war. They released a report by Lechter's office which challenged what he said were the myths put forth by New York City officials that New Jersey's growth is a threat to the city. New York is trying to convince the federal government that the best place for an Indian museum is right here in this state. And Lieutenant Governor Stan Lundeen is behind the project 100%. He spoke with Dave Gallatly about his efforts.
Finally, all the New York leading politicians have come together on a proposal to deal with the American Indian Museum, which is presently now in the northern part of Manhattan, in a building that just isn't suitable to properly exhibit this wonderful collection of Indian artifacts. All of us now agree that the Custom House in Lower Manhattan would be an excellent place for it. We have made an offer to the federal government that they, if they establish an American Indian Museum on the mall in Washington, we will make liberal lending of the artifacts that are a part of the American Indian Museum in New York to them so that they can always share in this magnificent collection. But we want to keep the museum basically headquartered in New York. I will state our position and try to convince them that it's in the national interest to keep this museum in New York, where the Statue of Liberty, the other great museums, the entryway of international travelers will draw significant tourists to see it.
Now, hasn't the counterproposal been made, though, that this should actually be part of the Smithsonian in Washington?
Senator Inouye is a sponsor of a bill to make the entire American Indian Museum collection a part of the Smithsonian. I think that would be unfortunate. I think by our proposal, you can get both the advantages for a Washington museum while retaining the trust fund intention to have the museum in New York. So we hope that he'll be open-minded and consider his position in light of this new offer.
What kind of state funding might be available for this project?
We have pledged $13 million in state and city funds in order to undertake the renovation of the Custom House. If those funds are insufficient, I'm confident that the legislature and the city council will cooperate with us in making an appropriate designation so that that building, that in that magnificent location on the New York Harbor, can be made into an appropriate museum honoring the American Indian.
Lieutenant Governor Stan Lundeen. It's a national scandal. That's how a Brooklyn Assemblywoman described New York's child support system. Democrat Helene Weinstein began joint Senate and Assembly hearings in New York City this week on legislation to establish a child support formula. Weinstein said that under the current system, child support awards vary considerably throughout the state, and she said they're often inadequate to support children. The proposed law requested by the governor would set a formula to give a specific sum depending on the number of children and the income of the parents. Each state must set up child support guidelines under legislation passed by Congress in 1984. A Love Canal situation may be developing in eastern upstate New York, with deadly chemicals once again threatening human, animal, and plant life. Bruce Robertson has prepared this report.
The environmental group Hudson River Sloop Clearwater is calling for a full-scale investigation of the Seba Geigy paint plant in Glens Falls, New York. Clearwater thus joins with the State Civil Service Employees Union, which has also been investigating Seba since last spring. More on that in a moment. Seba Geigy, in its manufacture of paint pigments, has been producing millions of pounds of heavy metal, PCB, and other chemical wastes, which have been disposed of in storage reservoirs and 50-gallon drums on site and in area landfills. Leaching over the past 30 years during the time Seba has been producing these waste products has also deposited tons of toxic sediment in the Hudson River just north of Albany, where the plant is located. Dredging operations by Department of Transportation workers brought them into contact with these chemicals, producing a higher-than-normal cancer rate. It was at that point that CSEA got involved, attempting to find out just what was going on behalf of DOT workers. Last spring, a state health department report was labeled as, quote, a whitewash in a massive report prepared by the State Environmental Conservation Commission. Working with CSEA, ENCON officials had been carrying out investigations into the levels and amounts of pollutants as a result of a planned cold shutdown by Seba next year. By law, when such a move is commenced and announced by a company handling toxic or hazardous materials, both health and ENCON representatives must be involved to ensure proper and safe disposal. So far, Seba has been cooperating in the investigation, which has been limited to the immediate campus of Seba Geigy. Now, though, a new study released by ENCON wildlife pathologist Ward Stone indicates significant and widespread pollution farther afield. Clearwater Environmental Director Bridget Barkley wants Seba to widen the scope of its cleanup operations.
At this point, all they're considering is what's on site, what's specifically on the property of the plant itself. And that includes, at this point, I believe, looking at contamination and number of waste piles and lagoons on the site. But as I said, as of yet, they haven't considered looking off-site for contamination that spread from that plant, and that's where we think the plant is lacking.
CSEA President William McGowan, involved in the investigation since last spring, says it's an outrage that the recent publicity about this issue has come about through the Wildlife Department of ENCON. He says, quote, the state must consider the risk to fish and birds greater than the risk to people. Even still, ENCON and Seba are still limiting the cleanup operations to the plant area itself. Spokesman for ENCON, Edward Groneman.
To date, the Seba Geigy study has not gone beyond the plant boundaries. We would anticipate that any possible pollution outside of the boundaries would be investigated as the case goes forward.
Not long ago, General Electric, also a producer of high-level toxic pollutants, was cited and sued for dumping PCBs into the Hudson River. At 30 to 40 pounds a day, this is a relatively small amount compared to the 2,000 pounds per day produced by Seba Geigy. CSEA, ENCON, DOT, and now Clearwater want to know why and what's going to be done about it. With the possibility that some chemicals from Seba now can be found on roads in the North Country and in waters down the Hudson River, this problem begins to take on greater proportions. The state has documented evidence from as early as 1980 that it knew of this problem. The question is, why was nothing done then, and what is being done now? Seba has planned a shutdown at the end of next year, with a cleanup plan to be released in a few months. Reporting in Albany for the Legislative Gazette, this is Bruce Robertson.
And that's it for this week's Legislative Gazette. The show was produced and prepared by Brenda McMahon, and she had help this week from Maureen Small, Bruce Robertson, and Dave Galecki. We hope you enjoyed the program, and you'll tune in again next week for more on what's happening in and around New York State. Until then, I'm Don Decker. Alan Chartok will be back next week.
The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC News. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. This program is made possible with funds provided by the State University College at New Paltz.
Statewide satellite distribution of this program was made possible by the Lawrence Group, providing residents throughout New York State with total insurance coverage.